sister at night. So I use these as transitions on the tour, because in order to really understand slavery, we have to understand what slavery meant for women. Woodridge's story continued in another vignette on a slab to the right. I remember how my master used to would come and get my sister, make her take a bath and comb her hair, and take her down in the quarter all night, then have the nerve to come around the next day and ask her how she feel. When women were put on slave ships that crossed the Atlantic, it was common for white sailors to rape them during the journey. Sexual violence was ubiquitous throughout slavery, and it followed enslaved women wherever they went. The violence enacted on Julia's mother and sister are part of a long history in which black women were seen as both undesirable and sexually objectified. This is the illogic of white supremacy. It does not need intellectual continuity. The temptation is to say that this illogic dehumanizes its subject, though some historians argue that such a characterization is incorrect. Historian Walter Johnson aptly notes that the language of dehumanization is misleading because slavery depended upon the human capacities of enslaved people. It depended upon their reproduction. It depended upon their labor. And it depended upon their sentience. Enslaved people could be taught. Their intelligence made them valuable. They could be manipulated. Their desires could make them pliable. They could be terrorized. Their fear could make them controllable. And they could be tortured, beaten, starved, raped, humiliated, degraded. It is these last that are conventionally understood to be the most inhuman of slaveholders' actions and those that most dehumanized enslaved people. And yet, these actions epitomize the failure of this set of terms to capture what was at stake in slaveholding violence. The extent to which slaveholders depended upon violated slaves to bear witness, to provide satisfaction, to provide a living human register of slaveholders' power. Julia Woodridge's words lingered. When that man made Julia's sister lie down in his bed, he did not have to believe her to be less than human. He simply had to know that she did not have the power to stop him. To be sure, enslaved women often resisted these advances in ways large and small, but they were up against not only the physical power of the person enacting violence against them, but also the power of the state, the power of patriarchy, the power of a society. These acts were not only permissible, but legally encouraged. There were laws stating that almost any crime committed by a white person against a black person was in fact not a crime at all. The illogic of it all appears to reveal a simple linear truth that is often lost. Oppression is never about humanity or lack thereof. It is, and always has been, about power. I shared some of these parallels with Yvonne, and she nodded before closing her eyes and taking a deep breath, the sort of breath I have to imagine that she has taken many times. She reopened her eyes and said she thought endlessly about this idea of physical agency being stripped from the enslaved, and how one of the most insidious parts of it all was tied to the fact that this stripping away of agency did not end after they passed away. She started talking to me about the role that enslaved people played in the fields of science and medicine, how an enslaved person's body, dead or alive, was the site of experiments that propelled the entire medical field forward. A lot of medical schools, during the history of slavery, largely depended on cadavers of enslaved people, she said. That's who they practiced on. Black women's bodies were used in experiments to advance medicine, like the field of gynecology. We learn about from cradle to grave in history, but what about postmortem? What happened to black people postmortem? It's like their bodies are constantly being exploited at every age, even in their death. In her book, The Price for Their Pound of Flesh, historian Dinah Ramey Berry writes about how some of the country's top medical schools, places like Harvard, Universities of Maryland, Pennsylvania, and Virginia, use the corpses of enslaved people, often purchased on the black market, as tools for their research and medical education. The body trade was as elaborate as the transatlantic and domestic slave trade that transported Africans to the New World and resold African Americans on our soil, she wrote in an essay for the New York Times based on her research. But when enslaved people died, some were sold again and trafficked along the same roads and waterways they traveled while alive. Medical schools typically used the corpses of executed criminals or unclaimed bodies from prisons and almshouses, itself an abhorrent practice. But when there were not enough of those needed bodies for their anatomy classes, schools paid people to go to cemeteries and dig up the bodies of the enslaved. Yvonne continued, "We need to also understand that if any children were ever born, that plantation owner, of course, would have been enslaving his own child, which happened all the time. So a lot of our visitors are completely ignorant of this." According to James Roberts, an enslaved man who fought in the Revolutionary War and was sold in 1783 to a Louisiana plantation several years later, from 50 to 60 head of women were kept constantly for breeding. No man was allowed down there, save white men. From 20 to 25 children a year were bred on that plantation. As soon as they were ready for market, they are taken away and sold as mules or other cattle. I asked Yvonne about the visitors at the Whitney and if they were different from the people who might typically visit a plantation. "Most of our visitors are self-selecting," she said. "We don't get many people who come to our site not knowing where they're coming. Which is to say, no one is coming to the Whitney thinking they're only coming to admire the architecture of the big house. We get people who consider themselves fairly versed in this history." Then, she added a caveat, "but ultimately, they come from the same education system we all have." I wanted to get a sense from Yvonne if the white visitors experience the space differently from black visitors. I qualified my question with a recognition that any response would be a generalization that doesn't necessarily reflect the sentiments or experiences of an entire demographic of people, but still, I was curious. Number one question we get from white visitors: "I know slavery was bad. I don't mean it this way, but were there any good slave owners?" Yvonne took another deep breath, the frustration from thinking about the persistence of the question visible in her face, the look of someone professionally committed to patients, but personally exhausted by the emotional toll it has taken on her. "I really give a short but nuanced answer to that," she said. "Regardless of how these individuals fed the people that they owned, regardless of how they clothed them, regardless of if they never laid a hand on them, they were still sanctioning the system. You can't say, 'Hey, this person kidnapped your child, but they fed them well. They were a good person.' How absurd does that sound?" The question, even if visitors are unaware of it, is tied to decades of mainstream historical thought, in part thanks to the early 20th century historian Ulrich Bunnell Phillips, who propagated the idea that there were in fact many kind slave owners who provided a good life for their enslaved workers. Phillips' assertion was built on the premise that chattel slavery was a largely benevolent system designed to uplift, protect, and civilize an inferior African race. In his 1918 book, American Negro Slavery, Phillips wrote, "On the whole, the plantations were the best schools yet invented for the mass training of that sort of inert and backward people which the bulk of the American Negroes represented." As historian Drew Gilpin Faust has written, it wasn't until the 1956 publication of Kenneth M. Stamp's The Peculiar Institution, Slavery in the Antebellum South, that this widespread interpretation began to change. Stamp's history, unlike many of his predecessors, was written under the fundamental premise that black and white people were equal, something that earlier white historians did not accept as a given. Black visitors to the Whitney, on the other hand, bring to the plantation their own set of concerns, questions, and anxieties. At times, Yvonne has found that black visitors want the Whitney to go further when presenting its history to white visitors and tell an unadulterated story of violence and brutality, to throw away the veil, and to convey what so few plantations have ever been willing to acknowledge. If we're not talking enough about the brutality, like how people were beaten, how awfully they were treated, how young girls were raped, and things like that, sometimes people will think we are sanitizing this history, if we did not only tell it through the lens of depredation. We've got these complaints before. Totally fine. It's like, you guys didn't say enough about what we went through. You didn't tell people this. You didn't tell people this. You didn't tell people this. And I get it. I really do. It's like, I hear you. Yvonne's voice shifted to a mix of empathy imbued with a sense of resolution. First and foremost, we're a 90-minute tour. There ain't enough time. But also, we can't continue to view enslaved people only through the lens of what happened to them. We have to talk about who they were. We have to talk about their resiliency. We have to talk about their resistance. We have to talk about their strength, their determination, and the fact that they passed down legacies. Maybe they're not physical legacies, but they passed down legacies to generations, and those legacies are living well inside of African Americans today. She went on, if you can't see them for being people, you can't see me as a black person. I want to get you to see them, because I know as a black woman what my challenges in society have been. It's stemming from this history. So if I can't get you to see them, then you can't see the person standing right in front of you. The old slave quarters at the Whitney were built from wooden planks laid on top of and alongside one another, each panel shaved from cypress trees that once ornamented the banks of the river. On the small building's facade, the 2-century-old planks had been discolored by time and weather. The boards were a muted green that faded halfway down the wood, like the residue of tears that had never reached the bottom of its face. The slave quarter sat on several small brick foundations, with 3 unadorned wooden steps leading up to the porch and 2 entryways. The room felt fragile, like one wrong step might break a piece of history. Prior to the Civil War, there were 22 slave cabins at the Whitney Plantation. While most of the original cabins had been torn down, 2 survived, one of which we were standing in. Inside, small beams of light sliced through the holes in the wooden boards. Burst of air hissed through the cracks, licking the skin on my face and crawling under my wool hat. I'm getting our visitors to understand that we have very specific ideas of what comfort is, what food is. And those things don't apply here, Yvonne said as we stood inside the cabin. This is not a home. This is a structure to house people. It's small. It's noisy. It's exposed to the elements. Everything outside is inside. The emotional power of the structure makes it the sort of place where, no matter how many people are around, you feel like you're the only person there. The feeling was notably different from my experience of standing inside the cabin at Monticello. While the cabin at Monticello was a powerful recreation of the old slave quarters, there was something unique about running my hands over a 2-century-old piece of wood and knowing that an enslaved person's fingers had once traced those same cracks. There was something about listening to the creak of the floor and thinking how the board may have groaned under the bodies of people with no choice but to sleep directly on it. This is how, also, we link this history to the present, Yvonne said, because this cabin, inhabited by enslaved people, continued to be inhabited by their descendants until the year 1975. The slave cabins were surrounded by sugar kettles, a few of them original to the plantation. Large metal bowls filled with rainwater that had once been used to boil down juice from the cane. The presence of these bowls prompted the telling of a more holistic story regarding the slave trade. This gives us an insight into the larger economy of slavery and the fact that a lot of the sugar produced here didn't stay in Louisiana. It was sent up north to granulation facilities, Yvonne said. That gives us an opportunity to talk about the textile industry and the rise of industrialization. In the North, where were they getting that cotton from? It gives us an opportunity to talk about the larger linked economies of banks, insurance companies, slave traders. All of these things, all of these cottage industries that ultimately fed into this larger system of slavery, making it so people, when they come here, are not just focusing on the plantation owners. It was the entire society, and it was entire countries. It's so easy for people just to look at these plantation owners and be like, this history is awful. They were the bad guys. Yvonne paused. They were the bad guys, but what are the larger implications of a global society? In England, these factory workers were going to work in the 19th century, and all of a sudden molasses comes onto the market. There in England, for instance, sugar became cheaper and more accessible, something factory workers could buy, Yvonne pointed out. Poor people can now afford sweetener, which used to be reserved for the elite. I nodded. And so these individuals are going to work, and now they can start purchasing sweetener for their afternoon tea, and then they start to demand it. And that is in direct correlation to the people who are enslaved on these plantations. And so it helps people understand that it's not just so cut and dry. It's not just like those overseers were sadistic people. The plantations were morally bankrupt and corrupt. Yes, they were. But also in Europe, once the appetite for sugar and chocolate and coffee and cheap textiles and all these things started flooding the market and people can finally buy into this larger system of capitalism and consumption, who is at the other end of it? As Yvonne and I walked toward the big house, John Cummings, his white hair combed over from left to right under a large brimmed hat, drove toward us in a golf cart whose motor hummed in the chill air. His presence highlighted a remarkable fact about the Whitney Plantation. Almost every tour guide I had seen was a black woman. I pointed this out to Yvonne, and she smiled, nodding approvingly. We want this to be an African-American-run museum, predominantly. She clarified that there were some white tour guides, and we very much believe that white people should be doing this work too. But they felt strongly that a museum centered on the experiences of black people should be predominantly staffed by black people. While the majority of the staff might be black, John, who bought the property and developed it into a museum at his own expense, is a white man in his 80s. I first met John a few months before I visited the Whitney at his second home, an extensive plot of farmland in Middleburg, Virginia. We sat at the table in his kitchen, which smelled like ginger and green tea, as he rolled up his sleeves and leaned back in his chair, brimming with equal parts confidence and vigor. His thick white beard, wrapped around the bottom half of his face, his thin-framed rectangular glasses, sat slightly crooked, sliding slowly down his nose when he became especially animated. His southern Louisiana inflection rose and fell slowly and symphonically, with long pauses situating themselves in the middle of each self-deprecating sentence. He is a multimillionaire, engaged in answering the ongoing question of how to use his wealth, a white person who says he has come to understand, in the last quarter of his life, the totality of the oppression that black people have experienced. John grew up in New Orleans and attended Catholic schools from kindergarten through college, graduating from Loyola University, New Orleans, with a business and law degree. He became a successful lawyer, focusing on large class-action tort cases, opening offices in New Orleans, Philadelphia, and Seattle. While he was building and expanding his law practice, John found causes beyond the court. A self-proclaimed liberal, he worked alongside black activists to reopen the Audubon Park swimming pool in New Orleans when the city kept it closed to avoid making it an integrated facility. In addition to being an attorney, John had a successful career in real estate. One day, in 1998, he said, a friend gave him a call and told him that the old Whitney Plantation, which at the time was owned by the Plastics and Petrochemicals Corporation, Formosa, was for sale. At this point, he wasn't thinking of it for the site's historical significance. It was simply another potentially profitable real estate acquisition. The plantation was in bad shape, but John thought he would clean it up and, similar to what had been done with other plantations throughout the South, turn it into a tourist destination. That changed when he was given a report commissioned by Formosa. The company had hired independent experts to provide a history of the property in an attempt to mollify environmentalists and other advocacy groups concerned about a $700 million, 2,000-acre chemical plant being built beside the Mississippi River and occupying land with such historical significance. While much of the 8-volume document talked about the architecture and infrastructure on the land, it also outlined the plantation's slave trading past. I looked at the inventory, and there were 101 slaves then. There was a name, an age, a column for what they did on the plantation, John said. A dollar amount for every one of them. After reading the report, John started seeking out more documents about slavery. It was a different piece of inventory from another plantation that ultimately pushed him to make the Whitney into a place willing to reckon with the history he was confronting. Not at our plantation, but I saw an inventory where the woman was 29. I forget her name. He leaned forward and brought his hands together. I'm going to say it twice. There's a job on the plantation that was good breeder. She was a good breeder. Had 9 children in 11 years. Good breeder. He shook his head. Very few days start without me thinking about that. And that's when I changed. That's when I realized that I could not have this property and make it a tourist attraction that would glorify a life of people who exploited human beings. Couldn't do that anymore. I couldn't. He continued, I was embarrassed because here was this big shot from New Orleans, thought I was the smartest guy in the world, and I didn't know that. So I thought, what are you going to do about it, man? I knew if I didn't know it, everybody I knew with this color skin didn't know about it. He dragged the back of his fingers down his forearm. It was never in our education. John began the process of educating himself. As I got into studying slavery, and I've probably read 1,100 oral histories, I thought, sooner or later, I'm going to get to the one where the woman was not raped, or the man was not almost beaten to death or branded or his finger cut off or his ear was cut off trying to run away. But I haven't gotten there yet. He added, you get an eerie feeling, because it's their words, more or less, and you feel as though someone is talking to you who never had a voice, and all of a sudden, you feel very strange. It's not a feeling of guilt. It's a feeling of discovered ignorance. I don't know how else to explain it. When you wonder, how could this have happened and I didn't know about it? How could that happen? John has invested more than $10 million of his own money into the museum over the course of a 15-year restoration effort. When word got out that John was building a museum dedicated to slavery on a former plantation, some were skeptical of what he was doing and why he was doing it. During a conversation I had with Leon A. Waters, the local historian and activist called John arrogant and a chauvinist and questioned his motives as well as his approach to the Whitney. John told me there are people who have suggested that he is attempting to make money by exploiting the history of black suffering, a claim he fundamentally rebukes. I don't make any money here, he said. I spent $10 million here. And you can check, send somebody and audit the books. I don't get paid for anything. The volume of his voice was increasing, his tone shifting. I was putting up $100,000 a month just to get it going. The first day the Whitney Plantation opened, according to John, only 4 people showed up and 2 of them were lost. He guffawed at the memory. They were looking for another plantation, but I held them there and they went on the tour. Soon, though, word spread, and by the end of its first year, the Whitney had about 34,000 visitors, a considerable number for a plantation an hour away from New Orleans, with no other meaningful tourist draw. Steadily, the numbers continued to rise. In 2017, it had 68,000 visitors. When I talked to him at the end of 2018, he hoped to reach 200,000 annual visitors in the next 5 years, though these plans were interrupted when COVID-19 swept across the country in 2020. John believes that it is not enough for people to write about slavery from the towers of academia if so many of the works never reach a wide audience. He thinks the Whitney offers something different, something more dynamic. I've seen some of the greatest empirical studies, and they sit in library shelves gathering dust. Nobody reads them, he said. We want to go to the masses, man. We want to go to the masses. Clouds slid across the sky as if some invisible hand was pushing them along, as Yvonne and I walked over to the main office building on the plantation. Yvonne said she wanted to introduce me to Dr. Ibrahim Sek, John's partner in building the Whitney from its earliest days. Sek, a Senegalese historian and the Whitney's director of research, splits his time between southern Louisiana and the Senegalese capital city of Dakar. When we met, he had just arrived at the plantation from his home in New Orleans. Beneath Sek's coat, he wore a black and white plaid Oxford shirt, every button on the shirt fastened neatly up to his neck. The shirt was tucked into a pair of faded gray jeans that crinkled at the cuffs. His smooth, dark skin made it difficult to know his age. As he spoke, Sek was judicious with his movements. No lifted hand or stroked chin seemed to be done without purpose. While English is his fourth language, He spoke with eloquent fluency. The final consonants at the ends of his sentences would hum in the air above his lips before dissolving into the next word. Sek was born and raised in a town in northeast Senegal and went on to become a high school teacher in Dakar. During his time in the classroom, he told me, he was selected by the United States Information Agency to participate in their international visitor program, through which he visited several states as a part of a cultural exchange program. Mississippi was part of the trip, Sek said, the S's in Mississippi rolling together like the undercurrent of the river that shares its name. We visited Oxford, and they brought us to see the old Delta blues singer James Sun Thomas. When he started playing, I just melted. I said to myself, there's something that needs to be investigated here, along this river, along the Mississippi River. Listening to Thomas play, Sek heard and felt a direct connection to his homeland. The Delta blues is so close to our musical culture in the Sahara of Africa, he said. When we get closer to the desert, that's where you see many people singing along with the African banjo. Very sad songs. So I found many similarities there. Sek knew he wanted to study how this music had crossed an ocean and made its way to this small city in the American South. And he knew that understanding the history of the transatlantic slave trade, specifically the pathway from modern-day Senegal to the mouth of the Mississippi, was where he needed to start. Most African Americans don't know much about Africa and Africans, and most Africans don't know much about African Americans. They may know the music, they may know something related to the culture, they don't really know the history of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, he said. So, I really felt that there's a necessity for us to better know the diaspora, and I was so glad to be able to work on a topic like this. Sek felt that Louisiana was the perfect place to study. The Mississippi River, he said, was the main artery through which African culture was introduced here and became a very important part of the definition of American culture and identity. Sek started taking English language classes at the American Center Dakar while teaching full-time, in addition to beginning his doctorate at Cheikh Anta Diop University in Dakar. 6 years after his initial trip to Mississippi, he applied for and received a Fulbright grant, which took him back to the American South. He spent the next few years traveling back and forth between the U.S. and Senegal, eventually becoming an associate professor at the university while continuing to do his research. In 2000, he was introduced to John Cummings by Gwendolyn Mydlo Hall, the historian who had built the Afro-Louisiana History and Genealogy Database, and who had become a mentor to Sek after he had heard her speak in Senegal years earlier. From the very beginning, I felt a lot of commitment from him, Sek said of John Cummings. He is someone who can really listen, and once you convince him that this is the right thing to do, nobody can stop him. So, from the very beginning, I felt that he's not doing this for money. He's giving something to the community. I asked Sek if he was ever skeptical of John, a southern white multimillionaire whose actions rub more than a few people the wrong way. A man who asked him to cross an ocean, to help build something that was only then a flicker in his imagination. No, I was not worried, he said, shaking his head. Sometimes he may say something that may upset some people, but it's not like the willingness to hurt. It's just a misunderstanding. For Sek, no trepidation he might have felt could outweigh the potential benefits of being part of a project that would help people confront what their education had largely avoided, the yawning gap on slavery that he had observed during his time in the U.S. The problem with this country, and also all around the world, is miseducation. The miseducation of the mind and hidden history. I saw so much in the documents, in the archives, dived into the archives for so many years, so many things that I said, people need to know this. Of course, people have written about those things before I got involved, but I said to myself, books are really good, but who can read a book? Who can have access to books? This needs to be an open book, up under the sky, that people can come here and see. When people leave the Whitney, Sek wants them not only to be able to connect the dots between the intergenerational iterations of violence, but also to understand that the importation of Africans was responsible for both the economic foundation of this country as well as its culture. You see children being abused, women being abused, people being mutilated, decapitated, he said in reference to enslavement. But I always tell my visitors that we also need to go beyond all of that. Yes, of course, they did suffer a lot. They built the foundation of the economy of this country. Let's also go beyond all of that and see how they contributed to building the culture that all Americans are enjoying today, and also outside in the world. The culture is everywhere. And what makes American culture so active abroad, outside, has something to do with the culture that was born here on this plantation. I walked with Yvonne to an area of the plantation called the Field of Angels, which was built to honor the lives of 2,200 enslaved children who died here in St. John the Baptist Parish between 1823 and 1863. The plot of land had been made into a small brick courtyard, surrounded by granite plaques that were about waist high and that listed the children's names. At the center of the courtyard, on an elevated pillar, was a statue of a woman down on one knee. Her chest was bare, and a pair of large wings jutted out from just under the shoulder blades on her back. A heavily creased cloth was draped loosely around her midsection, falling over her legs to the ground near her feet. Her hair was pulled into several thick rows of braids, tugged horizontally across each side of her scalp. Her neck was smooth and curved, while her head was bent, eyes cast downward, looking at the limp body of the small child in her hands. My own son was a few months from turning 2 at the time, while his baby sister was a couple weeks from making her way into the world. The artist's rendering of this child, cradled in the angel's hands, evoked for me something I was unprepared for. I felt the blood leave my fingers and arrow toward my heart. I felt the saliva bubble up in the back of my throat, and the space around me became swollen with a grief I could not name. I had to actively push out of my head the image of my own child in those hands. I had to remind myself to breathe, because I realized I was not. These are their death records, names, dates that they died, how old they were when they died, Yvonne said. And if all the information was recorded, you also see the name of their mom. Most of the children died here as toddlers, died very young. She scanned the names on the granite slabs. Most of them died of malnutrition and disease. We do know, through others, that sometimes enslaved women would kill their own children because they didn't want them to grow up in the system. But we can't officially say that here because we don't know why these children died. But that is something that we do see in this history. Women making this really, really unimaginable decision because they understand, especially if they have young girls, what it would be like for them. After my visit to the Field of Angels, I walked back toward one of the slave cabins. I stood on the porch, looking out over as much of the plantation as my eyes would allow me to see, tracing the uneven cartography of the vast land. The sky had changed to a soft copper. More people had arrived, and the plantation bustled with activity on an increasingly chilly mid-afternoon. To my left was the big house, framed by a row of oak trees, whose branches bent like crooked crescent moons, wind chimes singing in their tangled limbs. The leaves had changed color, folded into themselves, and dressed the dirt on the cobblestone path in a thin blanket of brown foliage. The big house sat at the end of the road, alluring in its decadence, its white facade, with a dozen open doors and windows, wind slapping the shutters back and forth against the panes. Behind me was a memorial of intersecting white stone partitions, with the names of 100,000 people enslaved in Louisiana laid out across each black slab. It was similar to the Wall of Honor I had seen earlier in my visit, but far larger, with even more names. The walls of this memorial sat like shadows anchored to the ground, a labyrinth of lost voices etched into dark stone. It was staggering to consider the enormity of the number of people, and to consider what that number meant in the context of my own life. I thought about all of the descendants of these names and the lineage of black Louisianans who came after them, how the intergenerational progeny of names on these walls were possibly people I passed on the street, people I had gone to school with, people checking out their food next to me in the same grocery store. Perhaps they were members of my own family. Lineage is a strand of smoke, making its way into the sky, even though we can't always tell where it's coming from, even though sometimes we can't distinguish the smoke from the sky itself. In front of me, a tour passed by, being led by a black woman who, Yvonne had told me, was the descendant of one of the people once enslaved here. The visitors listened to her intently, nodding as she shared with them so much of what Yvonne had shared with me. I pulled a piece of paper from my pocket, an open book, Up Under the Sky. I had written the phrase in my notebook when it fell from Sex lips earlier that day in reference to the Whitney. After I had written it down, I had torn the page out of my book and folded it into my pocket. I held the paper, shifting the uneven edges of the ripped sheet between my fingers. The ink was now smudged from my body heat and the friction of rubbing against itself. I looked at the bleeding words. The Whitney exists as a laboratory for historical ambition, an experiment in rewriting what long ago was rewritten. It is a hammer attempting to unbend four centuries of crooked nails. It is a place asking the question, how do you tell a story that has been told the wrong way for so long? For some, it is a place that doesn't live up to its ambition, a scattered assortment of exhibits that fails to tell a cohesive story. For others, it is a necessary, even if imperfect, corrective against a history that has been misrepresented or ignored for so long, a place that does far more good than harm. From both perspectives, it has served as a catalyst for discussion around how plantations should reveal the truth of slavery in ways that few other places have. I stepped off the creaking porch of the slave cabin and turned around, looking in the direction of the memorial to the 1811 slave revolt, which sits on the plantation's edge. I thought of how I had grown up in Louisiana and had never been taught that the largest slave rebellion in U.S. history had happened just miles from the city that had raised me. I had never been taught that the Louisiana Purchase was the direct result of the Haitian Revolution, the uprising that laid the groundwork for all the slave revolts that followed in its wake. About 50 yards from the slave cabins was a large bell, its cylinder of cast iron widening at the lip as if trying to get a better look at the earth beneath it, its color dulled by years of exposure to the elements. A coiled rope, its pale brown fibers braided tightly together, was tied to the top of the bell and hung down at its side. Historically, the role of the bell on the plantation served two purposes. It was used to signal when it was time to go out into the fields at the beginning of the day and when it was time to return at the end of it. It was also used to summon enslaved people, often when someone was about to be punished, an audible marker of the terror that enslavers maintain. At the Whitney, this bell has been repurposed, reclaimed. As visitors move through the different parts of the plantation, they are invited to ring the bell in honor of all the people who had lived here and had died in the struggle for freedom. I pulled on the rope. The bell's metal tongue swung inside its body as its chime reverberated like a heavy heart. Angola Prison. I can't change what happened here. My memories of traveling up I-10 west from New Orleans are recollections of trips to Boy Scout camps, to soccer tournaments, and to visit my family in neighboring states. For others, this particular stretch of highway signals a very different kind of journey, one that brings them to the Louisiana State Penitentiary. I watch the city's high rises dissolve into long stretches of swamp and marshland, watch that marshland turn into swaths of green pastures, watch those pastures give way to yellow sweet gum trees with leaves colored by the changing season. On the bus ride to the prison, known by many as Angola, I sat next to Norris Henderson, a man I've known for years because of his political work around voting rights. Norris spent nearly 30 years incarcerated in Angola for a crime he maintains he did not commit. He has a neatly shaved bald head and a thin gray and black mustache. Born in 1953, he reminds me of a favorite childhood football coach, the way he engages each person with the sort of familiarity common to those who have grown up in places like New Orleans, where being family is contingent not on bloodlines, but on ties to a shared community, the same set of traditions, the same culture. Norris told me he had taken this trip to Angola more than 100 times since he was released in 2003. "I've been home 15 years, he said, leaning back in his seat. "I've been in Angola I would venture to say, once a month, every month, since I've been home. Nora sometimes does these sorts of tours in conjunction with the tour of the Whitney Plantation, 2 hours southeast of the prison, so that the connection between the two institutions and their respective histories can be made clear. If we want to end mass incarceration, we've got to kind of get the history of where it comes from, and how it still exists, and what that looks like. His voice has the texture of an old blues singer, his accent peppered with a quintessential New Orleans lilt. The way the vowels and words like point and joint evaporate off the tongue, replaced by a soft R that turns his language into jazz. The way words like corner walk around the edges of the mouth before slipping off into the wind. Norris is not an official tour guide of Angola, but after 27 years in prison there, he is intimately familiar with the landscape. Since his release, Norris has been an unceasing advocate of criminal justice reform in Louisiana and across the country. Only a few weeks before our visit, Norris has successfully led a coalition of incarcerated people, formerly incarcerated people, and their allies to end Louisiana's practice of non-unanimous jury decisions via a ballot measure that had amended the state constitution. Up until that point, Louisiana was one of only two states in the entire country, Oregon being the other, in which someone could be convicted of a felony without the jury coming to a unanimous decision. In his book, Jim Crow's Last Stand, Non-Unanimous Criminal Jury Verdicts in Louisiana, historian Thomas Aiello describes how the rationale for such a policy is not simply an innocent difference in respective state constitutions, but grounded in a history of racism. The policy, stemming from post-Reconstruction white supremacy, was meant to funnel black people into the convict leasing system, replacing, in part, the labor force lost as a result of emancipation. The policy also had the effect of suffocating the political and judicial power of black people in Louisiana. When the United States acquired Louisiana as a territory in 1803, it had unanimous juries. But following the Civil War, white Democrats across the South sought to subvert the rights of newly freed slaves by imposing a new system of control, convict leasing. The 13th Amendment barred involuntary servitude, quote, except as a punishment for a crime whereof the party shall have been duly convicted. The convict leasing system allowed black people to be imprisoned for years under spurious charges and to be rented to companies. These people and institutions whose businesses have been built on the labor of enslaved people experienced a vacuum in the years following abolition. But with convict leasing, imprisoned black men could now be legally forced to provide that labor for their railroads, their plantations, and their businesses. Many southern states passed so-called pig laws. In 1876, for example, the state of Mississippi established the theft of any property worth $10 or more and any livestock worth a dollar or more as grand larceny, and thus subject to a sentence as high as 5 years. Southerners constantly manipulated laws to drive convictions, said Aiello. Pig laws did create more convicts, and those convicts were overwhelmingly black and overwhelmingly leased. The conditions under convict leasing were often as gruesome as anything that had existed under slavery, so much so that in 1884, C. Harrison Parker, editor of the New Orleans Daily Picayune, wrote of the men sentenced to convict leasing at Angola that it would be more humane to punish with death all prisoners sentenced to a longer period than 6 years, since the average prisoner sentenced to convict leasing would not live more than 6 years anyway. As one man told the National Conference of Charities and Correction in 1883, before the war, we owned the Negroes. If a man had a good Negro, he could afford to take care of him. If he was sick, get a doctor. He might even put gold plugs in his teeth. But these convicts, we don't own them. One dies, get another. In Louisiana, in order to ensure there were more convictions and thus more prisoners available for labor, in 1880, the Louisiana State Legislature shifted the requirement for juries from unanimous to non-unanimous. This way, courts could allow a few black people to serve on the jury in accordance with their new rights as freed persons, but by requiring only 9 of the 12 jurors to convict someone of a crime, They effectively subverted any political power black people, or those sympathetic to them, might otherwise have had. Those responsible for the change did not equivocate in their rationale. The purpose of the 1898 convention, in which the new law officially became part of the Louisiana Constitution, was, as summarized by the chairman of the convention's Judiciary Committee, to establish the supremacy of the white race. A non-unanimous jury policy would invariably make it easier to convict people, and these convictions were a key part of Louisiana's convict leasing system. Despite its history, the law was upheld in a 1972 Supreme Court ruling and amended only slightly in 1973 from 9 out of 12 jurors being needed to convict to 10 out of 12. The Advocate, a newspaper in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, found that upon reviewing nearly 1,000 felony convictions between the years 2011 and 2016, 40% of convictions by 12-member juries had one or two jurors who did not agree with the verdict. Additionally, they found that in these cases, black defendants were about 30% more likely to be found guilty than their white counterparts. Innocence Project New Orleans, an organization committed to exonerating wrongly convicted people, has found that in the last 30 years, split juries played a role in upwards of 45% of exoneration cases in Louisiana that were eligible for a non-unanimous verdict. Norris said he thinks around 35% of the people in Angola were convicted by split juries. He then made a point that I had not considered. Throughout the state, non-unanimous juries had long been used by prosecutors as leverage to extract plea deals from defendants. If a prosecutor could go into a room, he said, and tell someone, "Look, all I need to do is get 10 of the 12 people on this jury to flip. I don't even need them all to believe me." It instills fear in the defendant that their odds of being found not guilty in court are incredibly limited. A lot of guys may have pled guilty before the trial to avoid having to be confronted with a 10-2 or an 11-1 verdict, Norris explained, making it impossible to know the true scale and cost of this law. The bus made a slow turn onto Highway 66, the road that serves as the prison's only entry point. The entrance to Angola looked as if it could be a truck stop on the side of the highway. There was a large white triangular overhang with a small booth underneath it, the type you see at toll stops on the interstate. Cars entered and exited on either side. At the center of the overhang was a black sign with bold red letters that read, "Louisiana State Penitentiary." To the right, before we entered, was the Angola Museum at the Louisiana State Penitentiary, a small white building with a long porch that covered the entire front-facing part of the property, the starting point of our tour. We were given time to walk through the museum on our own before we were scheduled to meet our guide for the day, back outside on the bus. The cool air tiptoed across my skin. It was November, but there were still gnats buzzing above the soft, wet earth. I was struck by how desolate the landscape felt, how unalive it looked. The sky was gray and endless, with sheets of clouds holding everything above it in place. Behind the clouds, small handfuls of light stretched thinly in every direction, and the breeze trembled above the uncut patches of grass in front of the museum. The first thing I saw inside the museum was the wall behind the checkout counter. On the wall was a 20-foot-wide image that kept my feet in place. Below the words, "Louisiana State Penitentiary," was a photograph of 24 black men being marched into the fields, each of them carrying a long black hoe. They were wearing an assortment of gray sweatshirts and white t-shirts that rendered their bodies almost indistinguishable. To their far right was a white woman on horseback, her long blonde ponytail extending from beneath her black cap and down her back. The sun, full and luminous, even in the black and white image, hung just above the trees in the distance, suggesting that these men were beginning their day. The procession of black skin carrying black hose into the field further erased the identities of each man. They existed in this photo not as individual people, but as a homogeneous, interchangeable mass of bodies. I turned away and then looked back multiple times to make sure I understood what I was seeing. The photo seemed to have been taken recently. It was not a vestige of the past. It was indeed a white person on horseback, herding a group of what seemed to be exclusively black men into a field where they were forced to work. The unsettling nature and placement of the image was compounded by the fact that it welcomed its visitors into a gift shop stockpiled with an extensive inventory brandishing the Angola name. As I walked around the relatively small room, there were various t-shirts touting the Angola Prison Rodeo, a biannual event that takes place every Sunday in October and over the course of one weekend in April. There were caps that read simply, Angola State Pen. There were ashtrays, built from license plates, stacked on top of one another. Angola is where every license plate in the state of Louisiana is made. I thought about the cruel irony of people so restricted in their own movements, creating something that facilitated mobility for so many others. There were shot glasses, sunglasses, and t-shirts with the prison's name emblazoned across their breasts. But what stood out most in the gift shop, sitting on a shelf at the far end of the store, was a white mug with the silhouette of a guard sitting in a watchtower surrounded by fencing. Above the picture it said, Angola. And beneath the picture it read, a gated community. I looked around the gift shop once more and wondered whom it was attempting to serve. Who saw the largest maximum security prison in the country as some sort of tourist destination? After I left the gift shop, I found a plaque inside the museum noting that the goal of the Angola Museum was to establish and preserve Angola's past and to educate all who visit about the role this sprawling prison farm has played in our state's history. But as I walked from room to room of the museum, it became clear that the institution was interested only in preserving a history that created clear, misguided demarcations between criminals and those who watch over them. Then, I stepped into a room dedicated to the Angola Prison Rodeo. It was filled with posters and photographs from rodeos of the past. There was even a mannequin, dressed in a black cowboy hat and large blue cowboy chaps. The self-proclaimed wildest show in the South brings tens of thousands of visitors to Angola every year. In his book, Slaves of the State, Black Incarceration from the Chain Gang to the Penitentiary, scholar Dennis Childs describes the scene of the rodeo. In the first event, a clown places a card table in the middle of the 6,000-person rodeo arena, around which four prisoners sit and pretend to play a game of cards. A modest monetary prize is awarded to the man who remains seated the longest as the bull attempts to gore all four contestants. For the second event, a large number of stripe-clad men attempt to remove a poker chip tied between the horns of a bull. Prisoners are regularly tossed over 20 feet in the air by the 2,000-pound animals. They also routinely suffer from broken bones, deep lacerations, and concussions as a result of the spectacle. One prisoner is known to have ultimately died from a heart attack resulting from his participation in one of the events. On the other side of the wall was a glass case holding photographs and memorabilia from several of the movies that had been filmed at Angola. In another room, a large glass encasement, entitled Inmate Weapons, displayed dozens of homemade items like shanks made from plastic toothbrushes, knives made from pieces of a broken typewriter, guns sent and smuggled inside. In another room, I found a wall that included photographs of administrators at Angola dating back to 1916. Looking down from the wall were the faces of 15 white men. In another room, there was a wall of men who had attempted to escape and been apprehended. And in another room, a display case held photographs of guards who had been killed by someone imprisoned at Angola. In each room, I caught the eyes of Samora, another person on the tour, and a musician and composer from Oakland, California, with messy black hair hidden beneath an orange beanie. Each time one of us glanced over, the other would furrow a brow, a silent but clear acknowledgement between us that something wasn't right here. Our walk through the museum continued. In one room, there was a replica of a cell that people could step into. In this context, so close to the gift shop, would the cell, I wondered, be anything more than a photo op for someone with their new Angola sweatshirt, smiling behind the bars? Would they pose, with a coffee mug in one hand and a shot glass in the other? In yet another room, a large ball and chain sat on the ground, its rusted links snaking across the floor. It weighed about 50 pounds, according to the placard, and when I tried to pick it up, I lost my footing. On the placard it said, "This was commonly used in the early days for problem prisoners." I looked at the words again and whispered the phrase, "problem prisoners," to feel the discomfort of the euphemism on my tongue. It seemed much of this museum, almost relentlessly, depicted images of violence. And yet paradoxically, its curators also sought to couple this violence with a narrative of progress, as if to show how bad the prison used to be and tout how incredibly safe it was now. The brochure of the museum states, "Once known as the bloodiest prison in America, the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola has emerged as one of the most progressive and well-managed prisons in the country." The final point on a timeline in the museum makes the espoused transformation more intimate. 1995 to 2016, Burl Cain becomes warden, begins massive expansion of education and moral rehabilitation programming. Violence inside the prison is dramatically reduced. Later, I spoke with Samora, hoping that our exchange glances did indeed reflect a shared sense of horror. Everything was like, "What's the most sensational thing we can talk about?" he said, which is kind of ironic, given the fact that, really, the most sensational and real thing you can talk about is actually the fact that it was a plantation and all the awful shit that happened there. But that was the one thing that wasn't a part of it. But then they wanted to talk about, like, who was the most notorious outlaw and all the crazy weapons that people are trying to use. So they were clearly trying to be like, these are the things that would attract people, but let's avoid the actual thing that's at the center of all this. The group left the museum and its accompanying gift shop and got back onto the bus to begin the tour inside the prison grounds. Once everyone was settled, Norris introduced us to our official guide for the day, an assistant warden at the prison I'll call Roger. Roger was a tall white man with a calm, even affect and dark, narrow eyes. He smiled as he looked at all of us on the bus, readjusting his jacket as he waited for conversation to die down so that he could begin. Roger opened by talking about the indigenous population who first lived on this land centuries ago. It was encouraging to hear him begin by naming the land's history. He explained that the indigenous Americans assisted French explorers in learning how to navigate the river so as to more effectively travel north. The Tunica shared with the French explorers that if you were paddling north in your canoe and you went through this bayou, you would save about 40 nautical miles on your trip north, which was a huge, big deal, he said. Those are some of the forgotten facts about the discoveries of the lower reaches of the Mississippi River, he continued. Then we move into the prison phase in 1869. Samuel James obtains a lease from the state of Louisiana to house its inmates. In 1880, he bought 8,000 acres, which we're currently on. James moved some of the state's prisoners to Angola, but many of them were subcontracted to work on levees and railroads. And conditions were horrible. About 10% of those folks did not survive under Samuel James' watch. Samuel James died here in Angola in 1894, one of the wealthiest men in the state, based solely on the backs of convict labor. In 1901, the state came in and assumed control of the prison, and we've been run by Louisiana since 1901. My initial sense of optimism began to fade away as Roger continued. He went on to say that this had been a horrible prison, but quickly pivoted to discuss the positive things the prison was now doing to make life better for the people held captive there, including providing accredited college courses and degrees from the New Orleans Baptist Theological Seminary. While it was encouraging to hear about the progress the prison had made, the timeline Roger provided seemed, at best, abbreviated, if not willfully misleading. Roger moved from discussing the indigenous communities and French exploration of the 17th and early 18th centuries straight to post-Civil War America, skipping the period in which Angola existed as a plantation worked by enslaved black people. He had mentioned convict leasing without explaining that it was an explicit tool of economic and racial subjugation in which men were starved, beaten, and housed in former slave quarters. He failed to mention that the land upon which Angola is built had once been the plantation of Isaac Franklin, a man whose business, Franklin and Armfield, became one of the largest slave trading firms in the United States. The plantation produced 3,100 bales of cotton a year, a yield higher than most other plantations in the South. He failed to mention that Samuel Lawrence James, who purchased the plantation from Franklin's widow, was a former major in the Confederate Army. James agreed to a 21-year lease with the state to purchase access to all of the state's prisoners, as long as he was able to keep all of the profits. James subsequently subcontracted the prisoners to labor camps, where, as Roger had told us, they worked on levees and railroads in horrific conditions. A prisoner under James' lease had a greater chance of dying than an enslaved person did. Upon approaching the building where executions took place, I felt my chest tighten and my mouth turn sour. Inside, the room adjacent to the execution chamber was unremarkable. At its center were two wooden tables brought together, their clean, polished surfaces reflecting the flickering fluorescent lights. The tables were surrounded by 10 armless, black, rolling office chairs set to different heights, some slightly reclined as if someone were sitting in them. Next to the back wall were two tall plants, their leaves bursting a full and healthy green. The walls were beige with white trim, and the floor was a neat aggregation of square linoleum tiles. The soft hum of the air conditioning vibrated throughout the room. With the exception of the large circular seal of the Louisiana Department of Corrections at the center of each table, it would have been easy to mistake this for any other conference room in any other office building. This was not any other conference room. This was the room where the people sentenced to be killed by the state of Louisiana had their final meals. They ate these meals, perhaps a hamburger and French fries, perhaps steak and mashed potatoes, maybe a basket of boiled crawfish and a bowl of gumbo, before being injected with a cocktail that rendered them unconscious, paralyzed their muscles, discontinued their breathing, and stopped their hearts. In the vestibule between the conference room and the execution chamber, 8 mahogany leather chairs were packed tightly together in 2 rows, the second row elevated slightly behind the first. On the far wall, there was a sliding wooden door, and on the other side of that sliding door were 4 more chairs, 2 in front and 2 behind, seated next to the window. The victim's family, if they so choose, would sit on one side of the sliding door, while witnesses, often the media, would sit on the other side. The family of the person being executed cannot be in the viewing chamber for the execution. In front of these chairs, on both sides, was a large glass panel that looked directly into the execution chamber and directly at the table upon which the person would be killed. As we walked into the room and slowly encircled the table at the center, the group fell silent. Many were unable to stare at it directly. Silent, but for a soft symphony of breaths, we were a congregation of lowered heads and sunken shoulders. The table was long and blue-black, its upholstery covering a thin layer of foam padding. 7 discolored brown and black straps, haunting in their stillness, stretched across the width of the bed, each locked and pulled tight. A small pillow rested at the head of the table where the person is meant to lie, and another set of straps would come down over their shoulders. About a foot below the pillow on either side of the bed were places where the soon-to-be-executed would lay their arms. On each of these arm-length extensions was a leather strap meant to be tightened near the person's elbow. They were noticeably different from the other straps, a faded blend of gray and brown, taut leather that had been cracked with age. The straps, with their procession of small notches, dangled below the table. At the foot of the table were two shackles, their silver metal glimmering under the lights. A hot rush of blood pulsed behind my ears, feeling the shame of being alive in a room built to kill. On the bus ride to Angola, Norris had told me a story about how this bed, or the one that came before it, had been made. He said that when the state of Louisiana transitioned from the electric chair to lethal injection in 1991, the prison needed a bed on which to lay the condemned. Meanwhile, in the welding shop of the prison, some of the men were handed a new assignment, though they did not know what for. One of the guys, one of the clerks, happened to see the whole blueprint laying on the drafting table, Norris said, recounting the event, and went back out into the shop and said, "Bruh, y'all know what you're building?" They're like, "What?" "You're building the damn deathbed." Instead of purchasing a bed, Norris said, the Department of Corrections found it cheaper to direct the prisoners in the machine and welding shops to build it, with each part of the bed assembled separately. Norris paused, shaking his head at the memory. One of the guys on the welding crew, his brother was on death row. Upon realizing what they were building, Norris said, the men refused to continue. And as a result, they were locked inside their cells. Word spread like wildfire because it was lunchtime when they was getting locked up. So when it came time for everybody to go back to work after lunch, everybody was like, "We're not going back to work." The prison, Norris said, was essentially at a standstill for 3 days. My mind jolted back to the room where I stood, between the table and the glass panel, looking at the table and then turning my head to look at the chairs on the other side of the glass. The chairs and glass turned this room into a spectacle of state-sanctioned, taxpayer-funded death. The table was a reminder of how fragile our bodies are, of how little is needed to extinguish a life. Robert Sawyer was the first person put to death by lethal injection in Louisiana in 1993.